The year 1960 Anno Domini saw the launch, pun intended, of the 727 model of Boeing's line of commercial aircraft, and then fully entered into service on February 1st of 1964. Coincidentally, it was also on this day that the Fab Four, known as the Beatles, hit number one on the United States pop charts with their classic crooning of I Want to Hold Your Hand. If you remember this exciting event in pop culture history, you should feel old, because you are, in fact, old. The 727 was used as a shorter-distance narrow-body alternative to its more robust 707 and serves as the only tri-jet in the entire series, meaning it has three jets, because it's tri. One of its major selling points was a reference to six abreast seating. I can hear you giggling from all the way over here. It was also so blasted loud that Boeing had to develop a hush kit in order for it to continue to be allowed to fly in the United States airspace. Australia outright banned the blasted thing, even with the hush kit, in the year 2010 because it was too good at masking rampant criminal activity. The latter part of that statement may or may not be true. It could carry a maximum of 129 passengers if you eliminated the first class seating area for all of the fabulously wealthy people who needed fresh green olives on their flight, and travel a maximum distance of 4,170 kilometers when fully fueled. The updated -200 model of this craft could seat a maximum of 155 passengers in single class, with a range of 4,720 kilometers in the unlikely event that you needed to get from New York to Utah for some preposterous reason. The -100 model could not fly that far, and you would crash in Colorado, and deserve to crash, because you were trying to get to Utah. The place is a blasted salt lake. It's a lake with salt water. God! Its final commercial voyage took place in January of 2019, and in total 1,832 were built over its production life cycle that itself ended in September of 1984. The 727 aircraft was apparently so popular and expensive that some nutjob decided that it would be a grand idea to actually steal one rather than put it on his credit card. It had been grounded in Luanda for 14 months until an American flight engineer and a mechanic from the Republic of Congo sauntered on board, taxied erratically without any form of lighting, refused communication requests from the control tower, and took off heading southwest over the Atlantic Ocean, never to be seen again. No debris field was ever found on land or at sea, which clearly means it was abducted by aliens and transported to their Museum of Universal Curiosities. Tickets for viewing are available from Ticketmaster. If you'd like more information about this aircraft and its history, go over to Wikipedia yourself, you lazy bastard. I'm not your organ grinder monkey.
Unless it's a proctologist,
nobody really wants to see an asshole.
Keep your germs to yourself. Wear a mask.
What's up, everybody? This is the SMO Podcast. I am your host, Joe. We got a fun party cast lined up for you, a bunch of friends dropping by, and someone new. Gasp and shock. Tim's here, Pernell's here, Chris is here, and Chris, you brought a friend, huh?
Oh, yeah, I did.
Introduce us.
Utopia. Oh, hi. Brooke, this is the podcast. And the podcast, this is Brooke.
Right.
Hey everybody, I'm Brooke and Chris's friend. You know, I play dating games, so that's why I'm here today.
How are you doing today, Brooke?
Pretty good, can't complain. It's 6 p.m.-ish over here in Pacific Standard Time. Just clocked out of work, ready to party.
All right, we'll take care of that.
I'm envious. I want it to be 6 o'clock on Pacific Standard Time, and I want to be in it where the sun shines and it doesn't get below 70 degrees, probably. I don't know.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
In Delaware, so it is always winter and never Christmas.
That is correct. Even during the summer, Santa's running around stealing all my shit.
And every 200
snow tonight.
And every 250 years, it turns out a president.
Yeah.
There it is. He's out there.
So Tim's getting somewhere. Snow, huh?
Fucking maybe. Yeah! Are you seriously saying it's supposed to snow? But and you're talking about in your area. You weren't just like randomly saying Delaware's getting snow.
Speaking No. I'm saying no. It's Buffalo. So, I mean, really, there's you're never too far away. But yeah, it might. True. It's a slim chance we might get some flakes tonight. I'll probably be asleep when it happens.
Maybe you'll luck out and it'll just be cornflakes and then you just have a hard
time. No, I think that would be worse. It smells like cornflakes sometimes out here. Well, there's a General Mills factory in South Buffalo. Sometimes it smells like Lucky Charms.
See, that really? Sounds like a deal.
This is 100% true fact about Buffalo is that sometimes it smells like cereal.
That's a pretty cool fact. Also pretty cool, Carnage just subbed for his 15th month. Thank you, Carnage. God. And then before the show, Root Beer subbed.
Oh, nice. Hi, Root Beer.
So thanks, everyone. Thanks for the subs.
Speaking of subs, Subway delicious just subbed subs. For the...
delicious Subway dinner. No.
That's what you need to sponsor the show, Subway.
I mean, I have a Subway in town. We out of our DoorDash selections, out of our four choices, we go to Subway probably most frequently. No.
There you go. Like, speaking of subs, we had multiple subs today. Speaking of
steak, egg, and cheese, buddy.
In over a decade.
Well, the chain itself is kind of going really downhill, which makes me sad because
it was never on top of the hill, Purnell.
No, it was never.
Hey, during $5 foot long town, it was as good as it needed to get. All right. That was my work lunch on a regular, and I saved a crap ton of money eating there. It was okay. Yeah, the bread was cardboard. I didn't give a shit. It had some cheese in it. It's okay. You know, and that worked well with that. You know, but then the $5 footlongs went away because apparently they had inflation. And then from there, it was like, well, the quality of the food didn't go up. The price of the food went up. But now I can just get food from anywhere else instead of this. Like, what is the point if it's not $5 footlongs anymore? It's like Little Caesars, $5 hot and ready. It's like, if they weren't $5, I'm not getting it.
So you said $5 foot long, but at one point it sounded like you said 5 hour foot long, and I was like thinking of a tiny sub sandwich in a bottle.
Just pop the bottle, just like start chugging like ground up sub.
Oh,
Well, it could work if you didn't have bread in it. Just like take like a freaking jardinera sauce. And then, like, grind up some ham and some lettuce.
I think you have invented the salad, Purnell.
The salad smoothie.
It's not bottled salad. It's not bottled salad. It's bottled sub.
It'd be a smoothie.
Maybe there's a bottled salad at the grocery store. I should go look for that, like, Beyond Salad.
So, Brooke, do you regret your decision to join us yet?
Absolutely, 100%, but I'm going to hang in there.
You say that now until you've had a bottled salad. You will change your mind. Maybe
I need to perk me up tonight. Nice bottle salad.
Delicious bottled salad.
I mean, you live in the land of innovation. Someone over there has got to produce one by now.
Hey, yeah.
This is the part where we cut to a commercial about bottled salad.
Do you like bottled salad?
Podcast now.
Did you ever want a salad?
I want a salad.
You're too busy running a marathon to sit down and eat it? Well, good news. Just pop the top and Beyond Salad is chuggable for you.
Has this ever happened to you? You want to eat a salad, but all you have is a cup holder.
It has happened to me, actually.
Purnell's Super Salad.
I just had no place to put the salad. I had no idea what to do.
Two cup holders, one for your soup, one for your salad.
Oh, shit.
That would be Beyond Soup. That's the companion product.
You know I'm going to have to talk to Norg and get him to make a commercial about bottled salad now, right?
Oh,
I think that was the sinister plan the entire time, Joe.
Yeah. Sorry, George. We love you. Funny enough, George did his second Boeing Facts intro for this episode of the show. For 717, he did a 4 minute long intro about Boeing 717 facts.
Jesus.
And now that it's episode 727, he did another 4 minute intro about Boeing 727s.
Surprising fact, they fly just like the 717s.
Spoiler alert, we're doing it for 737, 747, 750s.
What if 747 you forgot and it's not there? And that's the one everybody actually knows.
That's pretty much true.
That'll be we'll just skip that one. That'll be even better. Yeah. Everyone will be expecting that one. We're just like, nope, never mind. Bye.
See, now I realize that I wasn't around for episode 227. If you didn't play the No Place Like Home theme song, I feel sad because that was a golden opportunity for that episode number. But I also realize I'm an old man and most people don't even remember that fucking show anymore. Like what was it? Like I was at work the other day getting introduced to some new coworkers, or rather I was the new coworker, and they took me to office 227. He's like, this is such and such. This is her office. I'm like, No Place Like Home, huh? And she's like, what? I'm like, you know, with your families all around you. So it's like you're never alone in here, right? And she just looked at me and paused, like, oh, fucking hell. It's like, I'm leaving. I quit. This introduction's over.
Carnage says, my grandma used to watch 227.
Right? My back's going out right now.
No Pulse says 227 is the place to be.
Okay.
Well, see, I can
appreciate first that. We got emotional sharts and now we got bottled salad. What's next?
The word bar.
The reverse order.
The sky is the fucking limit.
Emotional salad and bottled sharts.
I feel like emotional salad is actually a thing someone did too. That sounds familiar.
What is wrong with us?
Clearly we're dappy. We're very dappy. And I've been drinking ginger Sprite, so that's my excuse.
And ooh, Purnell's getting crazy tonight.
That's right. All the hardcore liquors. It's ginger Sprite.
Purnell's inner party girl is gonna come out.
Oh, yeah, baby.
Woo! Topless in Seattle, but I'm in Delaware. Whatever.
I'm in classic gamer form over here with my white monster.
I'm the one partying over here. She's got a monster. Gotta slam that shit.
This is the gamer drink of choice right here.
I don't know. I've got a Mountain Dew Rise energy drink, so.
But the question is, do you have any Doritos crunched up in that Mountain Dew? That's important.
No, I do not have any Doritos crunchies mixed into my Mountain Dew.
Well, there you go. You got to step it up. That's the gamer drink of choice.
Yeah, at the very least, like, do a rimmed glass. Crush up the Doritos.
There it is. She nailed it. Inject some class into your gaming, damn it.
Yeah, thank you.
High quality, high class.
This is my world classic. Hello, welcome to the SML podcast. I'm your host Joe, and I have this nice Mountain Dew cosmopolitan with crushed dew shards around the rim of the glass that I sip. It's perfect. There's your SML drink of choice right there. Name it the SML served at party.
Wow. We really rubber banded into fancy territory, didn't we?
Yeah, we really did. Ketchup Doritos if you're Canadian. Oh my God.
See, this is the Purnell tangent portion of the show. That
my fault. I didn't do it. It just happened.
That's what happens every time.
Yes.
Should we get to reviews?
I guess, but they're not going to be as good as Rim Doritos. Oh, shit.
Sadly, that may be true.
Is that a Doritos rim job? What?
Brought it down. Oh. We were high class, Joe.
No, we weren't.
High class.
No, do I see some reviews on the horizon?
There, yonder with the Omaha steaks.
Resting the hill.
Man, all this fanciness is reminding me of Omaha steaks. Incredible.
All right, let's get to reviews. We got a lot of games to talk about tonight. Let's get to it. First game to talk about tonight is the Caligula Effect 2, developed by Furyu, published by NIS America, released October 19th on the Switch for $49.99. The Virtua Doll Regret creates Redo, a simulation in which people are trapped. To escape from Redo, a group of awakened high school students reestablish the Go Home Club to fight against regret's reign and escape to the real world. Purnell, what is going on? How, make sense of that, because I can't.
I swear to God, everything Purnell reviews is that.
Like, weird shit. Shit's happening. High it's school like, kids, step up. That's the trick. Well, Caligula Effect 2 is the sequel to a game that I never expected to get a sequel, but I am genuinely glad that it did. Because, honestly, I liked the first Caligula Effect a bit, but I had a few issues with it. But with this guy here, I'm not sure if they even fixed the issues, but I can say I came away feeling a little bit more, I enjoyed it a fair bit more already, just spoiling that out, get that out the way. Just like Joe said, the premise is that you are a high school student inside of the world called Redo. It's a quote-unquote simulation, I guess is the best way to describe it, where people end up when they – and this isn't a spoiler, this is like pretty much the beginning of the game and the plot. It's like when specific people who deal with certain traumas in the real world hear music from a specific idol, like a virtual idol, they end up being transported essentially into this world, where they are given a new identity and plopped into it, forgetting their old identity. So it's pretty much being reborn in this world. And their real self, well, we don't know what happens to them per se. We just know
they die.
They're in here. Honestly, I always wondered about that concept, but let's just assume that their body functions somewhere or somehow. I don't know. But as a result of this, these characters end up in this world, and they're kind of just stuck there. It's not right to say stuck there just yet, because for the most part, they're happy living there. It's a good place for them. They are living their ideal self lives. But after a certain point, certain individuals start to have weird nightmares or bad dreams. And when they have these bad dreams, that means that they are becoming cognizant of their real world self, which makes them a bug in the system at this point. And the premise of this game is essentially your main character being the first character to experience this, and he fuses with a virtual idol that intrudes and breaks into Redo, and then they collectively work together to try to work with this go-home club that they found and get the heck out. So it's actually a really cool premise, because one thing that's worth mentioning here, again, not a spoiler, it's just part of the game, is that you might have heard me talk in the past about how I wish more RPGs involved adult protagonists. And surprisingly enough, this game is that. Even though it takes place in the high school, everybody there is not the age they are in the game. Because, again, they're just thrown into this idyllic environment created by this character that's, for whatever reason, a freaking high school. I don't know why people are so obsessed with high school, but this is the youth part. But technically, a character could be 10 years old, 45 years old, 90 years old. Doesn't matter. Just depends on who they were before they came in. But I do like that premise of the game and the fact that these characters are interacting with each other and make these high school bodies or whatever. But
I wish I could go back to high school.
That's the weird thing about this game's premise. Like, honestly, high school, not so much. But if I could get my age with it, I'll make the sacrifice. But that's the cool thing about this game's premise. And then I'll finally talk about the damn gameplay. Is the fact that I think it does a great job of touching on like these aspects of like regret and like trauma and just issues with living life, like actual life issues. And one last thing, people might be hearing this and going, it's fucking Persona shit. It's just Persona, isn't it? Isn't that Persona? Well, thing about that that I think is worth mentioning is that, well, yeah, there's a lot of games that have done this, including Persona. But one of the lead writers on the Caligula Effect games is Satomi Tadashi, who was the writer or scenario writer for Persona 1 and 2. So basically, by that logic, he pretty much wrote the book on the concept. So I think he gets a pass for using his shit to do this. Though I wouldn't doubt that this has happened before those games, too, and we just kind of labeled it as Persona, like the whole Souls-like thing. But so how does the actual gameplay work? Well, but the first thing I worked on was talking about just the battles, because you'll be spending a fair bit of time in battles. Now, unlike the typical JRPG battle system, in this game you can have up to 4 party members in your battle. And when a sequence starts, your character, say one character, gets the ability to select a move. When you pick a move, rather than just say start use the move. Instead, you go to like a sort of time bar, and you can kind of scroll back and forth a certain amount of time on the time bar. And what this allows you to do is see potentially what your enemies are about to do. So it's like almost like looking into the future a bit. And the reason why you can do that is because your whole goal is to kind of sync up attacks to work in a way that they either counter enemies, allow you to evade enemies, or combo it with your teammates to do like cool combos. Like you might have a move that launches the enemy into the air, and then your friend with a crossbow fires crossbow bolts at the guy while he's in the air, which does combo damage. And then on the way down, your current with the Naginata slashes him and sends him across the room. Like, it's cool stuff like that. Now, the weird thing about that is, as it does sound, you might think, well, this could take a fair bit of time for each individual fight. And admittedly, it could if you get really meticulous. But thankfully, the game does offer like an auto battle mode, too, if you don't feel like dealing with that. And that does get you by a fair number some of the fights. But the bosses, you'll absolutely have to use combos and stuff.
Yeah.
But the whole point of the auto battle is that you control your main guy, and the computer, based on whatever one of the routine types you set, will make best guess decision on what the other character should be doing. For me personally, though, most of the time I spent doing stuff manually, and only when I felt like I was fighting guys that were a little below standard for me, I was like, all right, just do auto battle. We can just rip through these jerks and get by. Now, with that said, that means I like the battle system, because with the auto, it allows me to just kind of dice across it when the enemies aren't a challenge. So I'm not really bogged down on the time front. I think that's a nice improvement over the last game, because I don't remember that one having an auto battle mode, but it's good here. Now, outside of battle, this is where it gets a little interesting. So the equipment in this game, a few things. One, the equipment is not your standard swords and shields and whatever. Instead, they are personality traits and characteristics, as odd as that may sound. So you might have an attack called Free Thought, or Attack from the Back or something. I don't know, whatever. And that is just the naming scheme of the game has for this stuff, like various personality traits and stuff. They give you various attack buffs and defense buffs, like equipment generally does, but they also serve an additional function. Some items, when you equip them, allow you to learn a sub-skill, which can be equipped once you've mastered it. Similar to like how Final Fantasy IX lets you learn skills. In addition to that, sometimes on sub-quests, which I'll mention in a second, you might need a certain personality trait or characteristic to fulfill the quest obligation. And to do that, you'll have to equip the actual thing to say, hey, I'm persuasive because I have this actual characteristic, so I can now help this person. Which honestly can be fun, except for one thing. And that's that it brings back the same issue that I kind of have with the first game, which is that the side quest system, which is where these things take place, is massive as balls. Like, there's just a ton of random NPCs in this game world that you can come across that will have like relationships with other NPCs in the game world. And when you talk to them, you create a relationship with them, and occasionally get requests to help these people out, and you'll just be inundated with them at a certain point. There's so many friggin' side quests that I had a lot of trouble even sticking with them half the time. I was just like, I'll fulfill them when I can. Otherwise, screw it. But one thing I don't recall noticing in the last time when I played it, but I noticed it in this one, which I think actually helps make me want to solve them when I can, is that remember how I mentioned how these people end up in redo or whatever? So when you manage to max out a NPC's quest line, right, you're able to bring up their identity on the social media called Link Site, which that's a whole other thing. and it shows their normal profile. Like, this is the person, this is their age, you know, their background, whatever. But if you can press a button that shows you their out of redo name and age and personality and their actual trauma or social, you know, concern that brought them there in the first place. Like, I'm learning words from this freaking game that I've never heard of before. Like, one person was there because they lost the ability to feel joy in things they did. Like, they just lost interest in life. It was like a really weird thing, but there's an actual word for it. Yeah, but did you know there's an actual word for it? I didn't.
That's probably German.
No. And you know how many weird words English has? English is riddled with words that no one knows and uses because we just have too damn many.
We're uncultured swine.
No, we're overly cultured swine. That's the disturbing part. We have tons of culture, but we never interact with it because all we care about is bullshit like, you know, sports and I don't know, politics and other bullshit. But we have culture. We just don't utilize it for anything that matters. It sucks. But yeah, honestly, I do like that aspect of the game. And I do feel like this game does a better job of getting the ball rolling on getting the narrative started instead of just like dumping you into a school. Instead, you're running, you're actually put in a dungeon at the very beginning of the game after, you know, the main story narrative beats, and you're set to go off running. And I actually preferred that a lot to the last game's introductions. I do feel that first dungeon and subsequent dungeons can run a bit long, but it's a Japanese RPG. You don't fucking do. Just play it.
Dungeons, a lot of people, lots of side quests. The game's sitting at $50. What are you thinking on this one?
I genuinely like it, and I do think it's a solid buy it in this case. I'm only going to say the word buy it once, so buy it. Yeah, one time. Buy it.
That was four. Yeah, right.
I definitely do think this is worth the slice, though, and I think I gave try it for the first game, but I think this one's more of a solid on a buy it scale, so grab it.
Is it worth a delicious Omaha steak?
I don't know. I mean, it'd be worth a delicious Omaha steak to me, but I'd rather someone give me the steak to let them try my copy of the game. That way I win twice.
Editing note, this is where we go into our second Omaha Steaks commercial.
Do you like meat straight from a cow's ass?
Do you like cow ass?
Oh, grilled my. To perfection.
Grilled cow ass from Omaha Steaks. It's fucking yummy.
If we're going to get an ad before, we're not getting it now.
No, no, we're not. No, we are never getting an ad. Next game to talk about is Tunch, developed by Leap Game Studios, published by Hype Train Digital, released November 2nd on Xbox One, Switch, PS4, and PC for $19.99. Tunch is a charming hand-drawn action game with roguelike elements. Team up with your friends or play solo. Choose from 5 unique characters and restore peace in the Amazon rainforest. Tim, tell us about this one.
All right. Yeah, it's Tunch. It is sort of a beat-em-up roguelite deal. They, at least to me, clearly took some inspirations away from Hades at some point as to how to construct your roguelite.
What? Let's pancakes!
About this game. The good things about this game. This game has really nice art. It has a, you know, South American, Amazonian, tribal rainforest theme to it, which is cool in general. I think the characters themselves look really nice. The playable characters, so you got 5 characters. There's like 5 original characters for this game, and then like the Hat Girl from A Hat in Time.
Yeah, I'm looking at screenshots, and I see Hat Kid, and I'm like, what the hell?
Yeah, yep, they're just there.
Okay, I won't argue.
This game was kickstarted, so maybe like an incentive was like, we'll put in the Hat Kid, and whatever. It's
where's fine. Shovel Knight? I mean,
yeah,
Shovel Knight's in everything.
Where's Shovel Knight? You get what you can get, I suppose. So yeah, I think the character art looks good. The animation is really nice. Has a cool setting. Has like some good ideas. So what you do is you pick yourself a character, one of the 5, any one of the 5. Hat Girl isn't even like something you need to unlock. She's just there sitting around the campfire with no explanation.
Sometimes you just don't need an explanation.
You just don't.
Yeah.
So you will go out into the jungle. You will do some beat-em-upping of enemies that pop up in front of you, and once you clear a screen of enemies, you will a reward will pop up first with a very nice flowery reward animation that I really like. And then sometimes you'll just have one place you can go, but sometimes you'll have a choice of 2, and it'll have like a little bubble that shows what the reward is for that next room, which is something that I associate with Hades, which is one of the first reasons why I brought that up. So you can pick your reward and then move on. And as you move your way through, you know, you'll gain currency. Some currency can be spent after a run is over to unlock things. Some currency is for within the run to spend at shops. You will find abilities. There's not a huge pool of different abilities, and none of them are like super awesome or significant, in my opinion. It's just like, oh, well, this one will give you a little bit of healing off of certain attacks, and this one will do a little bit of damage if as you glide over top of enemies. This one will, there's a like Devil May Cry style combo system to it, and there's one that's like, ah, you'll move faster when you are at a high rating of combo, and it's like, okay, but none of them are like super game changing. None of them make one run stand out from another, which is an issue we may revisit. So you'll fight your way through after a certain number of very similar looking areas in a particular zone, fighting a bunch of pretty similar enemies. You'll come to a boss, you beat up the boss, and then you move on to the next area, of which there are four. You get a healing potion, and every character starts out with a like a ranged attack that keys off of a magic meter that you have. So it's a pretty generous meter. You can spam it out there, though. It's not a super powerful ranged attack, so enemies will still swarm in on you. And other than that, you can jump, you have a roll, and you have a three-hit combo to start things off. And every character has those things to start out, and not else. So it gets tedious real fast from a beat-em-up, just straight-up gameplay point of view, and that all you have at your disposal is like, well, I got my three hits. Just tap, 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 tap. Tap, 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 tap. Throw in some ranged attack here every now and then, but that's it for the combat. And the game does not have a massive variety of enemies in a zone. It's like four or five, but it really leans very heavily on like different colored frogs. Like, they all look the same, but just they have slightly different attacks or movements to them, but there's a lot of them. I really can't stress enough how many fucking frogs you're gonna fight in this game. And even once you get out of the first zone, like, there's still frogs around. Like, that's like your basic enemy for the game is this frog. It changes up some of the other things that come at you, but a lot of the game is frogs. I really cannot emphasize that enough.
Anyways, made this game a fly.
Yeah, you beat something that loves eating frogs, wants to see frogs punished. I don't understand. So you'll finish your run, and hopefully you will have beaten a boss and maybe gotten a little further to get yourself some of the most important currency in this game, which is essence, because essence is what you use to upgrade your characters. Kind of a bummer is that the essence you collect as a character is locked to that character. Like, you don't get any kind of global thing for upgrading your characters, which is bothersome because the game is kind of stingy with the essence, and you need that essence to unlock more abilities and moves for combat to make the combat more interesting. But it's really a grind to get that going. Because the only time you can purchase those abilities is when a run is over. So you still got to grind through these runs with very little, variety to your attacks just to get the ability to start unlocking some more variety to your movements and your abilities. And this was also a problem with another game a few years ago called River City Ransom Underground, where they started out your characters with no goddamn moves, and it was like so horrendous trying to get going in that game because it's just like, well, I don't have a lot of good moves, and it takes a lot of work to grind out currency to buy more and get going, and you just end up straight up not having a good time. Some of the other things you can do with your currency is you can upgrade those aforementioned abilities that weren't terribly significant, but you can upgrade them so that when you find them again on future runs or with other characters, this is one thing that does is global. They will be upgraded versions of themselves. So you'll get more health for that little health bonus that sometimes procs when you shoot an enemy. But for all this game has going for it in terms of like its look and its ideas, it is just like
It sounds like it's lacking in the execution.
It is lacking in the execution. It's a thing where they either need to like give you more currency when you finish a run, or they need to give you more moves up front to make the characters more fun to play. And there's still only four areas. It's not like there's a like whopping boatload of content here either. So really, like, by the, you will probably, and there's multiple skill trees. I forgot to mention that. Like, there is like your moves, then there's other things for like range attacks and how you're like increasing your health potion count and stuff like that. So some characters have like three or four different skill trees, but like by the time you actually see all the content of the game, like you're going to reach that point before you reach the end of any of those skill trees. And that sucks. Like, I was just like, you know, the areas are not, I didn't feel like they were short, because it's just going into these rooms, which are, it's just a flat room. Like, there's nothing really that distinguishes one from another. They don't have like different layouts or like significantly different art. It's just like a flat, maybe like 1.5 screen area that will quickly fill up with enemies that are all over your ass. And you beat them up, and then you move on to the next room, which is like the same thing. And you're not getting stuff on the runs that like really makes it stand out. It was like, oh man, I got a cool build going on. It's like, well, I got one of these abilities this time, or I'm getting a decent amount of currency that I can use once this run is over. And so then it's like I get into this kind of fatalistic mode where I'm just like, I just want to die so I can like buy some upgrades. Like, I'm just so done. Like, once you start getting in, you know, it becomes super tedious at a point, and it's not fun, and it's a real bummer.
Damn.
Because of how cool it is. And also, the music in the first area at least sucks. It's better in the second area, but in the first area it's just kind of some like really faint, generic, like kind of tribal drumming sounds. And one thing I feel when you are, because this game, at least in gameplay, is a beat 'em up, is like you really need like some really good music to go with a beat 'em up style game.
Fight music.
Yeah, you need violent fight music, but it's something that like really, you know, keeps you pumped as you are doing something that, you know, these games can be tedious, as much as I am a defender of the genre, but it's an important key of the genre to have really thumping music, and this doesn't have that either.
No.
It's a bummer.
As it sits, it's $20. What are your thoughts on it?
It's extremely harsh to say that you should deny it, that you should not buy it, but that's like where I'm at on it. It's like, I just can't see. Well, okay. The one exception is if you have, it supports four players locally, and I think you could have fun four player couch co-op, like grinding this game. It's still going to take you time to upgrade those characters, but it's definitely going to be more fun than playing by yourself. But yeah, like, other than that particular scenario, it just seems like you are cruising for some tedium to play this game. And I really hope they tighten it up and kind of smooth some of those things out and just make it more fun to play. Cause right now it is just, it's not like all the pieces are there except for the fun. Give me the fun.
Oh man. Well, if they do some updates and some fixes, we'll take another look at it. Yeah, but for now, I guess we'll have to hold off on it.
They also did that to River City Ransom Underground. They redid it, redid the progression, and gave characters more moves early on so that it was a better start to the game.
See, it's doable.
It's doable, and it's happened with that specific example. Yeah.
Next game to talk about is Cupid Parasite, developed by Otomate, published by Idea Factory International, released November 2nd on the Switch for $49.99. What's love got to do with it? In this divine romantic comedy, plays Lynette Mirror, Cupid Corporation's top bridal advisor, and none other than Celestia, goddess of love, Cupid. Determined to prove that love is more than bows and arrows, she meets her biggest challenge yet, the infamous Parasite 5. But in finding love for the Parasite 5, will Cupid find love herself? Brooke, tell us about Cupid Parasite.
All right. Well, before I launch into the review itself, for any listeners out there who aren't familiar with Otome games, the Otome game is just a dating game, visual novel, typically marketed to very young Japanese girls, like middle school and teenage. Generally, not any mature content in these games at all. So you might ask, why are these games so popular right now? Why do they cost $50. And why am I playing these as an American woman in my mid 30s? And
all questions.
So many questions. I wish I knew, but I'm still figuring that out. And so is America. But let's talk about you. You're the main character of our story. Like Joe said, you're a beautiful young professional. You're one of the top bridal advisors for Cupid Corporation, which is the most famous matchmaking company in the whole world, located in bustling Los York, USA. You're actually almost the number one bridal advisor ever, but you have been assigned a seemingly impossible task. You might just be able to pull it off because, as Joe said, you're no normal bridal advisor. You have a secret identity. You're the Roman god of love, Cupid, and you're here in disguise. Because you made a deal with your dad, Mars, and you've got to match make the five least eligible bachelors of all time, the Parasite Five. So what does Parasite even mean in this game? What kind of connotation are they going for? You know, we never know for sure because we're never actually told. But it seems to mean that a Parasite is someone that just for the love of trying cannot get married because they're just too annoying. So let's do a quick overview of these five men, the Parasite Five. First, we have Raul Aconite. He is a famous actor from Sillywood, California. Maybe you Americans have heard of that point. He's known as the obsessed Parasite. Don't worry, he's not obsessed with you. He's only obsessed with Roman mythology. Oh, wait, you know, that is us. Anyway, plenty of girls want to be with a young, rich, handsome Sillywood actor such as himself. If only he could shut up about mythology for like 5 seconds. He could probably get married, but he can't. Next, we have Gil Lovecraft. He's a great guy, romantic, doting. He really wants to get married, but he wants it too much. Comes on too strong, tries too hard. He shows up an hour early to every date, texts incessantly until the girl gets there. Then he tries to cut up her food for her at the dinner table, won't take no for an answer.
Come on, man.
As much as he wants love, he just can't have it. And that's why we call him the Lovelorn Parasite. Next, we have Alan Melville. He's a famous pillow salesman. Alan just can't be interested in a woman unless he's already committed to someone else. But how's he ever supposed to get married if he's only interested in married women? This is why Alan is known as the thieving parasite. Next,
I like that it's a pillow salesman, like fucking Michael Lindell's in this game.
Oh my god, dude, this guy's so great. He's a pillow salesman, and he basically hits on women in his own pillow commercials. He's seen as a ladies' man. He's definitely like we just love him. He's decked out in purple. He's got eyeliner. He's super goth. He's got like a choker on. This guy's the real deal. He's the thieving parasite.
Where he's talking to a woman and she's like clearly uncomfortable during the commercial. Like, is this an ad or what? Is this a script?
This is the kind of ad we're going to be having on the show. We're going to be selling pillows. We're going to be getting oxygen. Anyway, we've got Ryuki. He's the glamour parasite. His character portrait in this game is actually drawn holding a spray bottle of water so he can spray anyone he thinks looks under moisturized. He just can't stand people who don't take care of their skin. If you've seen JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, my favorite anime, he is definitely just a 19-year-old version of Rohan. But Ryuki isn't interested in romance or marriage at all. He doesn't see the point of it. His grandma signed him up for this because, according to her, he'll never be taken seriously as a world-class fashion designer until he comes to understand true love. And for as rude and entitled as he is, if there's one thing he respects, it's his grandma. This brings us to our fifth parasite, the final parasite, Shelby Snail, the prestige parasite. He is the president of Cupid Corporation. But wait a second, that's where you work. That's your boss. That's the guy who gave you this assignment. What? That's not going to be good for HR. Anyway, his thing is he's a CEO. He's too busy for love. But that's like really sad because the reason he thinks he even needs prestige is because he just really wants women to like him. Ugh, these parasites, man. They can only get it together and get married. But as you're
they all seem so realistic.
They all seem much more irresistible than the last.
Just like the pillow salesman. I'm imagining just that Mike Lindell, my pillow dickhead. Just like, oh, they stole the election. Come date me.
Shit. So here you are one night complaining to your roommate that you'll never match make any of these guys. They're too annoying. They're impossible. But your roommate looks at you and she goes, yeah, you're a real hypocrite, dude, because acting like you know everything about love and marriage just because you're a romantic advisor, your dark secret is you've never even been in love. So how would you move? Why shouldn't anybody listen to you? You're the biggest parasite of them all, the Cupid parasite.
Oh, snap.
And I know all this sounds like super silly, and it's really, really silly, but I actually really love this game. It's a great time. For Atome Games, it's just top notch. It reminds me of, and these words may not mean anything to you gentlemen, but it reminds me of if Voltage Entertainment USA did a full-length Atome game and not just a goofy phone game. If those words mean anything to you and that sounds good to you, you will adore this game. It has an amazing aesthetic. It's got like hot pink 50s rock and roll meets 80s and vaporwave. It's got killer backgrounds and character design. They really pulled out the stops for this. Great voice cast. And honestly, soundtrack-wise, this instantly went up to the top of like my 10 all-time favorite game soundtracks.
Ooh.
And we're just talking visual novels. My boyfriend and I were jamming out to this. He loved it. It's actually got a really funny, good soundtrack. So if you want to talk about the controls of the game, they're easy, they're intuitive. Visual novels always are, but this is even easier than your classic visual novel at this price point. Editing previous choices without penalty and rewinding is actually way easier and more straightforward than most of these type of games. Overall, this game's like above average acceptable. I do have one controls critique. If you're going to play this game and you want to use the skip feature, it was pretty hard for me to figure out. If you're going to be using that feature, please know that if you're playing on Switch, you need to press the left trigger to select the type of skip. Then you press Y to actually start the skip. This took me forever to figure out. They don't come out and tell you. Other than that, as far as completion difficulty, they've got some handy dandy heart icons. Sound effect features are there to guide you, let you know exactly when you've made a choice that increases a character's affection. Yeah, and Joe, we were talking about how there is a bug that they're going to patch in a few weeks.
Yeah, they sent out a press alert saying that there are a handful of issues that they're going to be addressing in the coming weeks. There is a patch in the works. It's being submitted. Just comes down to when they can get it approved and when they could get it out there.
Well, the good news is if you are chomping at the bit and you can't wait to play Cupid Parasite, this isn't a game-breaking bug. There are some text overlay issues and a little bit of like localization problems, but everything's really clear. It's not going to crash your game. And since we have kind of like a rom-com atmosphere going on for this game, you're not going to miss any plot points. They're going to explain everything 3 or 4 times. You're going to be fine. So. Although, you know, it's going to be good that patch comes out. It's not a reason to not play it, in my opinion, before it comes out.
Yeah, so, yeah, pulling up the email, it says that fans can expect a patch to be released within approximately 4 weeks that will fix unedited dialogue between two of the routes, grammar fixes, and some text overflow issues. So those will all be addressed. But sounds like you're enjoying this one. So for $50, what are your thoughts on Cupid Parasite?
Oh, for established fans of the Atome genre, no doubt. I rate this as a serious buy it. For people who haven't played an Atome visual novel before, I'd call this a try it, but only if a really goofy choose-your-own-adventure romance story game appeals to you, because that's basically what this is. That's all these games are. And that's why I love them. I'm super into that, and only God can judge me.
Sounds good. Well, you're done. Do you want to stick around, or are you going to head out?
Thanks. I'll chill for a little bit.
You'll chill for a little bit? Sounds good. We'll keep you around. Next game to talk about is Godstrike, developed by Overpowered Team, published by Freedom Games. It released October 14th on Xbox One and PS4 for $14.99. Godstrike is a 3D boss rush bullet hell based on time. This means you have to face every boss and defeat them before your time runs out. Time is money and health, so buying abilities or being damaged will reduce your remaining combat time. You better watch out. Tim, tell us about Godstrike.
You better watch out. You better not cry. Yeah, that copy really kind of explains the whole game because it's very straightforward. This is a boss rush type game that has that is a Jesus. Sorry, this is irritating me.
Would you break?
I was just fidgeting with the various Legos that are on my desk and wanted to reattach one before I continued. Otherwise, it just wouldn't happen. So yeah, this is a boss rush type game with 10-ish bosses in it. And you're control of your character takes the form of that of a twin stick shooter, where you control with the left stick and you aim and shoot with the right stick, and you will eventually be able to put abilities up on your bumpers and triggers for access during your battles. As the game says, you are on the clock in these battles. You will have a certain amount of minutes. Like, each battle is rated a different number of minutes. And you can take penalties to that time limit by adding more abilities to your character before you go in. You have the option. There's like a little hub between each boss fight, and you can go up and add there's both passive and active abilities, but each one you equip. So if you want a say a dash on your character, that's going to cost you like 15-20 seconds. If you want some kind of rocket attack to your character, that's going to cost you some seconds as well. And that can be very costly unto itself, because your time limit is also your life bar. So when you take damage in a fight, your life bar also, when you take damage, you take a penalty to your time. So like, if you take a big attack, you might just get 30 seconds chonked off your time right then and there. If it's like smaller than that, it'll be less than that. But that's how it goes. That's the push and pull of this game, is everything hinges on that bar that is both your time limit and your life bar. So in practice, in a battle, when your life bar when the time hits zero, which is the most likely scenario, you're not going to get killed straight out, is you will take some bumps and bruises and gouges and lose some limbs along the way, but your timer will hit zero. And once it hits zero, you can take one more hit and then you are dead completely. So it kind of gives you a last stand mechanic when you're in the battles. As the copy mentioned, it is a bullet hell bullshit coming at you in these battles. You are controlling and fighting in a twin stick fashion, but the boss is filling the screen with bullets and different patterns of things that you need to avoid as you keep chipping away at them to try to take them out. The aforementioned active abilities, something I kind of don't like, is that you still have to pick up energy in the battle in order to power those abilities. So yeah, you can sacrifice some time to get that dash, but you like the dash is limited use. Like you have to, the bosses will drop these little blue energy things and you have to pick those up in order to actually charge up those abilities for you. So it's not like you take the penalty and you just get free use of these handy dandy abilities. It's like you still have to work for them and choose where to use them carefully. And this game is a motherfucker. It is so fucking hard, because everything hinges on that bar, to move things along. The tutorial boss is tough, and there's a arena mode, which I'll talk about in a second. And then the story mode, I could not get past the first fucking boss.
It's
just so goddamn hard. And I enjoy me some hard games, but it was so hard. But that first boss has uniquely demonstrates some of the game's problems in that, one, the bullet hell can be very difficult to parse sometimes, because everything is done polygonally. So sometimes both it being kind of a 3D sort of not quite overhead view, it's like a little bit of a three quarters. Like some of the bullets will have a goddamn shadow. And I think this is a unforgivable sin to have your bullets have shadows in a bullet hell game, because it just makes it that much more difficult to parse. Also making it difficult to parse on that stage in particular is that you're fighting in the desert and like the ground is this burnt, orange sandy desert color, and the bullets coming out are also orange. And it just makes it really difficult. Like in the best bullet hell games that I've played, The bullets are very easy to pick out and distinguish from the background. That is not the case with this game. Like, if you are colorblind, this game thinks you can go fuck yourself, because there is nothing you can do about that in the options. But ouch. Even besides that, yeah, it doesn't say that in those words in the options.
That'd be funny if it did. Colorblind options switch. Oh, go fuck yourself. Wait, what? Go fuck
yourself. Yeah, no. But yeah, like, even as myself, who is not colorblind, it's just like it was just hard to read screens. But the main thing is just like it has no difficulty like selection at all. It would be great if you could just give yourself more, like a bunch more time. Like, give me an easy mode. Give me like 15 minutes of a tiny health bar, or make it so like either there is a time limit or a health bar, like one or the other, so I don't have to worry about the two of them in concert, just so you can like play the game and like build up your skills more. To the game's credit, the arena mode, which I mentioned, is fantastic as a mode, because you can just select whatever boss you want. You can pick whatever ability loadout that you want. Like, everything is unlocked. You can jump between them to practice the bosses and see what the game has to offer. But the problem is just like, it's just so damn hard that it isn't ultimately fun to play around with. This game just desperately needs some kind of adjustability for the difficulty so that you can find a sweet spot for yourself. But just like over and over and over again, I would find myself in a situation where it's like, oh, I just took enough damage and I'm on the boss's, third or sometimes even second of four forms, and I'm already on my last hit. And there's just like no way I'm going to survive this. And it's such a bummer. Besides that, there is some pretty noticeable graphical glitching sometimes. It mostly pops up when a boss is like, there's like a little animation between form changes where like there'll just be like this black box artifacting around the character model that just like looks bad, and you know, is a thing that you'd hope that could be smoothed out pretty soon. But overall, it's just, this game is really hard to recommend for anyone outside of like the most hardcore of hardcore twin stick bullet hell boss rush people that are looking for a hard ass game to play, because I think everyone else is just going to get so frustrated and put it down in like 15 minutes.
So your solution would be to just adjustable difficulties.
Yeah, we just need some adjustable difficulty. That is the biggest thing, because then that opens up the game so much more, I think, to just having fun with it. And that's it. And it seems pretty easy, though. You know, I think the readability of the bullet hell, as it were, is certainly a problem. That would make the game better. But the main thing is just extending some kind of an olive branch to the player to make it more playable. And I feel like they could be a little more lenient with the abilities as well. Just make the game more fun. It's not dissimilar from the issues I had with Tunch. It's just like there's elements there, but you're just holding back the fun from me for one. In this case, it's just to make, you know, a super hard game.
Drew Van Camp is asking, will you be satisfied to win a game that is easier?
Yeah.
There you go, Drew. Just easy. Yes.
I'm fine with that. Yeah. No, I'm past that point in my life where I feel it's like okay, everything Drew. Needs to be super hard. Hey, you know, I...
Drew, I'm the resident challenge.
Yeah. Purnell's a total bonehead when it comes to that stuff. But I, you know, there are some games that I go into and I want that challenge, but I want it to be, you know, to feel fair. And I don't want it in every single game, but, you know, I am a man of the Soul series. You know, I am a man that plays a lot of pretty difficult shoot 'em up games. So it's not like I hate difficulty, but it's just like, man, I can feel when it's just not right.
Yeah. Well, this one's only $15. What are your thoughts?
No, don't. Unless you're at that that end where you're really looking for someone hard. Most people, I think, are just not going to have a good time with this unless, of course, they
rebalance and rework it.
Add some more difficulty. Add a slider for that time bar, man. Just that's it. Feels easy peasy. Then work your way down.
Cool. All right. Well, that is it for you, Tim. We will let you get going.
I'm going to bed. I'm going sleepy time.
Do you have any final words before we let you go?
No, I didn't think of any good.
Nothing good.
Puns for this week. Sorry.
Play with your
Maybe
Legos.
Maybe next time. Yeah. Good night.
Omaha Steaks. Next game to talk about is Roki, developed by Polygon Treehouse, published by United Label, released October 28th on Xbox One and PS4 for $19.99. Rediscover magic and chart your adventure through this forgotten northern world of mystery and monsters. Find your courage, discover hidden paths, solve ancient puzzles, and travel deeper through the icy land to learn the truth. Pernell, tell us about Roki.
See, it just goes to show you how short this review is going to be, because even the general dialogue there revealed like nothing. Because this is a adventure, you know, puzzle adventure game, which means the entire premise of the game is to experience the narrative. So you can't really talk much about it. But what I can say is just the general concepts of it, which is that you play as a girl named Tove. I swear, up until a certain point, I kept wanting to call her Roki, because that's the title of the game. But there is a reason why you don't call her that, because there's something else relates to Roki. But Tove and her brother Lars are a young pair who get along. They don't make much money in their family, but they get by along with their father in an old shack in the Northern Lands, because I don't think they even gave a name for where they're at, just the Northern Lands, essentially. But oddly enough, one day something crazy happened, resulting in her losing her brother and ending up in a not quite normal place where magic still exists and things get real in the form of like actual threats that could, you know, hurt her, but also wonders that will amaze her as she goes on an adventure to try to relocate and save her brother from whatever the heck I can't tell you. So the idea behind this game is pretty cool, and I like the premise of it because, as you already know, I'm kind of a sucker for games that involve children going on, magical adventures. I don't know. It's like how some people are obsessed with high school. I don't know. I'm obsessed with kids going on adventures and the like. So that's my wheelhouse. And this game does a great job of portraying that. The game is broken up into various, segments. And during those segments, you're kind of exploring a large environment broken up into many subsections, like, for example, a mansion or a graveyard or a snow-covered, forest or a shack or a mountain. All these things could be in one general environment area. And the idea will be that you need to solve puzzles to progress. So, like, the general idea might be, I want to rescue a family. They're all interconnected, and I need to save each member of this family in order to progress the plot. Well, to save the family members, you might need to knock down an obstacle, like some vines, to get to one of them. But now you need to figure out a way to cut down the vines, which will lead you to a place that has some vine cutters, but the vine cutters are behind a gate that is locked. How do you open the locked gate? And as you can probably guess from what I'm trying to lay out here, you find yourself hitting a string of puzzles that one benefits the other, benefits the other, benefits the other. Or in some cases, you might see a puzzle that initially you won't know what it benefits. You just know it's there and you might want to resolve it. So you'll end up looking around, finding clues. You might find a few items that go in your inventory. And inventory items can be combined sometimes to make a new item. But ultimately, when you want to use an item, you just click on it, hold down the button, drag the cursor to the object you want to use it on. Like, you might want to cook some porridge. So you take the oats and drag them over to a pot. And when you let go, it'll put the oats in the pot, right? So that generally ends up being the actual command schema for the game. Running around, investigating things, combining items, using items, helping people, evading people, all kinds of cool stuff.
Can I say one of my biggest problems with this game? Because it's adorable. I love the puzzles. I love the visuals. I love the story. There's just too much backtracking.
Oh, yeah. Because that goes into the... But I will say some things I do like about it, though the backtracking is definitely still there. I think much of the backtracking is because they want to give you that, like, larger scope of, like, how puzzles work. Because some games, they'll give you, like, three rooms, so say, and those three rooms have everything you need to solve everything in those three rooms, which makes it easier to churn down and process, okay, I solved this by doing this, by doing this. But in this game, being that it's so widespread out, I believe it's harder to pull it off. And while I definitely do agree that the backtracking can get annoying, they do open up options during, depending on the chapters you're in, to make backtracking a little bit easier too. Like at the aforementioned family members in that particular area of the game, once you start saving them, you unlock portals to go between them. So it's like, okay, if I need to get on from one side of the forest to the other, yeah, there's still going to be a bit of running involved, but at least I can teleport from this half of the forest to the other half of the forest and do my thing. So I think that's an interesting aspect in that it can be a double-edged sword. So on one hand, it's awesome that the puzzles are a little harder to figure out, not because they're obtuse, but because they give you a lot to work with. But at the same time, part of the reason why that's the case is because they spread puzzle elements across a large area.
Nah, Drew is asking, is it too much backtracking or too much bad backtracking? I want to say it's too much bad backtracking because it's just like, climb all the way over here to get this one thing that goes all the way the fuck over there, and then you get that, and then you got to go all the way back to where you were to do something else, to go all the way back where you were to do the other thing, but then you got to stop in the middle to go back to the other area to get something that goes back to the first place. I can deal with backtracking, but there's a lot of backtracking in this, and it eats up too much time.
There's definitely a lot of backtracking. I'm definitely not going to go so far as to say that there isn't a lot of it. I agree with that. But I also sometimes wonder, and this is a harder thing to gauge because every person plays these games differently, in that I wonder sometimes how much of the backtracking was because the game actually was like, you have to do this, and how much of it was elements where I personally got stuck and didn't realize something. So I ran to one side of the map when I didn't have to, and did something, and then ran all the way back. It's like, oh, now I can do this thing. But I never technically had to go that far to get that far back to do the thing. I can definitely tell you there were a few times where I was like, oh, shit, I could have just done this. And I've had to run all the way over there. In fact, early in the game, when you first get to the other place, quote unquote, I didn't realize for the longest time that I could actually go through a forested clearing on the right side of the screen, which had me running all over the place on the left side until I finally decided to go back and check and go, oh, crap, there's a whole other door here, which then opened up a sea of other possibilities. So that's what I mean. It's like, it's hard for me to say how much of the backtracking is the game and how much of it was me. But I won't deny that there is a lot of backtracking regardless of the fact. It's just how much is too much for a person. That's for them to decide.
Yeah.
But I will say that I did like the atmosphere the game put up, and I did like the characters and the dialogue they had. I'm that dorky guy who also even liked when like the characters had like fake Zelda-like language, where she's like, "Losh, hosh, mo." I like weird
Losh,
fake words.
Losh,
I loved it. I'm like, I kept wanting to say an actual word, but I'm like, you know what? I'm okay.
Lars is good,
like,
enough. Just keep saying Lars. I'm happy with Lars.
Lars.
Lars. Well, Roki is sitting at $20. What are your thoughts on this one?
I'd say if you're already fond of adventure games and the like, I think this is a good enough one to go with a buy. But if the, you know, the backtracking concern is there for you, and since we can't genuinely give you a hard point of like, this is definitely the case, then definitely look at it as a try it, not a buy. See, Joe? I'm catching it. So like for me it would be a buy, but if the backtracking is concerned, wait for it as a try. Catch it on like a sale or something.
Cool. All right, next game is Cotton 100%, developed by Polystar Success and In-In Games, published by In-In Games, released October 29th on Switch and PS4 for $14.99. The world has fallen into darkness, and the fairy Silk sets out to look for help. She crosses paths with a young witch called Nada de Cotton, who seems rather uninterested in helping her. That is, until Silk tells her that along the way, giant willows, a candy that Cotton has a massive craving for, are waiting for her. So the two set out to find what's causing the darkness, or look for willows. Chris, tell us about Cotton 100%.
Why does that sound so familiar? So a few months ago, I don't know, I reviewed the Cotton Reloaded game, which had come out on Switch and was a port of the old arcade game, the first in the Cotton series of side-scrolling shoot-em-ups, or shmups, or STGs, if you prefer. And so basically, that was the first game. It got released by the same people. And so Cotton 100% is the second game in the series, which came out exclusively for the Super Famicom in Japan. However, it's kind of a retelling of the exact same game. This is, like, the same thing, a side-scrolling shoot-em-up. You star as a witchy lady who is on the search for candy, and she has fairy friends. Her one fairy friend is Silk, although fairies in this game, you can actually collect more of them, and they act kind of like option ships, so I've given them other names. There's Wool and Terry and Polyester Blend. Jeez. Those are the other fairies. Yeah. And so the Super Nintendo game. Good night, everybody.
Polyester Blend.
I love Polyester Blend. I mean the fairy. But anyways, I should have named one Spandex. Anyway, let's get onto the game. So this is a side-scrolling cute 'em up. Okay, cute instead of shoot. Right? I didn't make up that term.
Yeah, says it on the store page, 90s cute-em-up action.
But I stand a cute-em-up. I think it's good. You are tasked with scrolling to the right and shooting everything in sight. So the difference in this game versus the arcade game is basically they did weird things with it where it's like they repurposed some of the bosses but put them in different levels and with different powers. It's almost like how Kirby games work. It's like Kirby always has like the same enemies, but they're a little different every time, and they're like also kind of like familiar and stuff. So like this one has, you know, basically the Wispy Wood boss, the scary tree, but the scary tree is in a later level, and it also has dangerous, adorable squirrels that throw nuts at you and stuff. And so it's like it's great, and you know, it had instead of the giant Grim Reaper with the thing, it's a zombie lady doll kind of thing. Anyway, that might be more scary, but so the game is similar, but not exactly the same. It's not just a port, but it's also not quite a sequel because while this game has yet to be translated to English, apparently there's a patch coming soon. The story and storyboards and stuff, like the cutscenes between every stage, is exactly the same as the arcade game. So it is telling the same story of, you know, girl meets fairy, fairy tells girl that she must save the world in exchange for candy, you know, girl saves world and then finds out the candy was what she needed to save the world, so she doesn't get to eat it, and therefore, you know, it was a trick the whole time. Or treat. Actually, I realized that Cotton is the perfect Halloween game because, you know, it's a witchy thing and it's entirely motivated by candy, and some people are weirdly too into it. So that's my comparison there.
Oh, God, I did want to address something you mentioned before about the text. In our review email, it says, please note at present the game menu text and UI is only available in English, and the cutscenes are in their original Japanese version. This goes for both Cotton 100% and Panorama Cotton. The next patch will contain full menu and UI localization and cutscene subtitles in English, French, German, Italian, Spanish, and Japanese, and the patch will be implemented in the following weeks. So the game will be updated to have full English translation.
Excellent. except for the Italian part.
Yeah.
So the the actual, so of course, this being a port, or sorry, not a port, well, it is a port, but I'm saying a modern port of an old game. We got to talk about the you know, the stuff on the outside of it, and NN did a fantastic job of this. I don't know if it was Success or NN. I think it was NN. NN's the publisher, right?
Yeah, so I think they're doing the developing too.
Oh, okay, yeah, cool.
I think they're handling all the porting, but I'm not too positive.
Gotcha. So in this game, we've got new modes. We have basically like kind of easy mode, quote unquote. The difficulty you don't actually set in the menu because the game itself has difficulty settings, right? And Brooke got my joke. Great. Excellent. Anyways, so it's got like an easy mode, which allows you to use rewind mode and some other like good stuff like that. I'm trying to see what it is. But anyways, mostly it enables rewind mode and, of course, cheats mode and things like that. And then you have the original mode, which is just a straight up, this is the game, you get nothing extra with it. But of course, you can do save states, load states. And here's what I really like about this, and this is going to go for, this is more important for the next game, but for this game, fully remappable controls, which is super good if you're going to play this with a Super Nintendo controller, and you want to make sure that you get the authentic experience there.
Nice.
So that's really, yeah, it's really cool. And then, yeah, so they have all that, and they also have a cheats mode, but they cheekily don't allow you to access them until you've beaten the game in the standard mode, that is to say, without any kind of rewinding or anything, so that's how it goes.
No, well, the game is sitting at $15. What do you think of this one?
Absolutely worth it. Yeah, if you're a shmup fan, it is worth it. It goes for $100 on freaking eBay right
Holy
now.
Holy shit.
So. Just for a card only, if you want a box and stuff, that's like $200. Also of note is that Strictly Limited is going to be handling a physical release of this game and Panorama Cotton, not only on Switch and PS4 physically, and with special editions that contain like everything. Like it has like a freaking mug in it and everything. And it's not even that. It's a sub $100 collector's edition that they're also reprinting. Not reprinting, for the first time printing an actual Super Nintendo cartridge for this game that you can have for a cool $57.99 plus tax, I think, USD, yeah. So,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, so you can add this to your actual Super Nintendo shelf if you prefer.
Nice, but the $15 is a buy it?
Yeah, I'd say for fans of Cotton, it's just different enough from the original that it does feel like a new game, but but yeah, and I'll touch on that a little bit in the next review, too.
Yeah, because if that one doesn't do it for you, the next one is Panorama Cotton, developed by Sunsoft Success and NN Games, published by NN Games. It released October 29th on Switch and PS4 for $14.99. The game's main character is Nadade Cotton, a witch with unquenchable craving for candy called Willow. She's accompanied by the fairy Silk, who Cotton saved the world with once before. Silk is approached by her sister Knit, who tells her that Queen Velvet has been acting strange. Identifying the source of her behavior as a burnt willow, Silk tries to dispose of it, but Cotton crosses her path, grabs the willow, and tries to eat it, only to realize that it has been burned. She doesn't care much about the queen or the kingdom, but is angered by the fact that someone is burning willows, so Cotton and Silk set off to stop whoever is doing such evil things. So she doesn't give a shit about the kingdom, but the candy.
No. No, she is exactly motivated by candy. This is who Cotton is. Also Knit, come on. My polyester blend was a much better name. Knit. Okay. So Panorama Cotton, this is the one I'm excited to talk about because it's not like the other game. This is the third game in the series, and I suppose you could say the first proper sequel because, again, the last game has the exact same story as the first game. So Panorama Cotton came out on the Mega Drive in the same year as the Super Nintendo game, 100% Cotton. Both of them came out in 1994. Panorama Cotton, like I said, Mega Drive exclusive. This is a behind-the-shoulder rail shooter instead of a side-scrolling shmup. And shmup. So this is, or cute 'em up rather, come up. So this one is actually more fashioned after something like Space Harrier or Galaxy Force 2, both of which, you know, famously had Genesis ports, even though they were arcade games originally. This, since it was built from the ground up to work on the Genesis, blows those two out of the water. This game is a visual knockout on, like, you know, on Genesis hardware. That is to say, it is like full backgrounds, like, you know, it's got like some rotations and some like camera changes and things like that. It's like it's like basically, you know, like kind of what Star Fox was going for, but sprite based. And yeah, it's super good as far as that goes. And it really faithfully recreates the style of game that it is. So, you know, using like spells instead of bombs as like your special selection, you know, gaining levels, even tea time at the end of every single stage where you catch cups of tea for bonus points and levels. All that stuff is in there, except now it's being done in a completely different presentation. And this game actually received a lot of notoriety all throughout, like, you know, especially when emulation was coming up and you know, it got fan translated at one point, for the fact that it really did push the Mega Drive to its limit in looking fantastic, sounding fantastic. So, yeah, a Mega Drive card of this actually will set you back. I looked at eBay on this today. It starts at $650.
Jesus.
For a Mega Drive card. Yeah. So this is a hotly anticipated port. And once that patch comes out, it's going to be the first time it's officially in English. So I'm really excited about that.
Holy hell.
Yeah. So, yeah, it basically, you know, I couldn't follow the story because it's Japanese, but you can tell from the illustrations. It's like, you know, Cotton is clearly pissed off about this burnt willow stuff. You know, she does not like her candy burnt, and you know, and fair play to her. And yeah, this game, like, instead of giving you like the kind of like, I would say, like, you know, sort of standard shoot 'em up levels, but every enemy is like super cute and like, you know, bosses are like cool and interesting and like all that. This game just goes completely bonkers because it's pretty much fully 3D. So it's like, you know, part of the stage might look like the Sonic 2, like bonus levels with like the checkerboards going by. But then it'll just be like, it'll open up into like this wide sky and they just like throw crazy enemies at you like all the time. And it's great because they get just close enough to the screen where you can usually pick out what the actual enemies are. And like, you know, just saying like, walls that you have to burst through made of cartoonish old men, a boss, a big robot boss the size of the entire screen but riding a tiny unicycle, like, oh, there's God. So much, yeah, there's so much cool stuff that goes into this game, and it's literally insane. So of the two, this was the one I am much more excited about, and I really enjoy this one. It's a little harder than the other one, but of course, just like the other one, you do have a mode that gives you the rewind feature, and then of course you have the original mode, which takes that away, and then you have the cheats mode, which you have to beat the regular game to obtain. And again, more important even than the last game, this game features fully remappable controls. Now what that means is that if, like me, you own a Genesis Mini, or you bought like a third party, like 8BitDo or whoever, Genesis controller, those notoriously don't map correctly to Switch, because Switch uses the shoulder buttons for like Z and C on a 6-button controller. So C is usually the X button, and that includes on a 6-button Genesis controller, or if you're using a 3-button, it's absent altogether. So in this game, you can change the buttons to be whatever you like, therefore you can map it to where it's fully compatible with a Genesis controller for that authentic feel.
Ooh, fancy.
Although I will say I loved using the joystick with this one. That really helps with that. And this will be important to Joe. You can invert Y-axis, I believe.
Good.
I think that's. Let me double check that though. Oh, you know what? Actually, no, I don't think you can.
Oh no.
I mean, here's the thing though, with this kind of shooter, I actually do like down to be down and up to be up rather than opposites. You're controlling a character. You're not controlling the camera.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
When you're controlling the character, it's completely different.
Yeah. So that's how this is mapped. So gotcha. It's not odd. Yeah. It feels perfectly fine.
Well, it's $15 on this one. What are your thoughts?
Even if you don't buy any other Cotton game, this is the one to get just to experience a truly badass Genesis rail shooter. Because again, Genesis, you know, they had some good arcade conversions with Space Harrier, Galaxy Forks 2, and the like. But this one was built from the ground up to be just an exceptional shooter, and I'm really, really into it. So yeah, this is the better one of the two, in my opinion.
Cool. Sounds good. All right, next up is Danger Scavenger, developed by Star Drifters, published by Forever Entertainment, released October 29th on Xbox One and PS4 for $9.99. Danger Scavenger is an intense cyberpunk-themed roguelite skyline crawler that takes you to the roofs of a breathtaking cyberpunk city where you will face ruthless enemies controlled by the soulless AI. Purnell, tell us about Danger Scavenger.
So Danger Scavenger starts out in a sort of like, I guess, like, operation control room. We have to choose between a group of individuals who I guess are the Danger Scavengers. I just decided they were a group called that. And based on who you choose, you then get to choose a starting weapon. And then you are left to go into the wild, so to speak. Now, the difference between these characters as individuals is that they each have a unique, I guess, ability, like their dodge ability. So one character might, say, for example, dash across the room when you hit their dodge attack or dodge ability button. Whereas another person, which admittedly took me a while to figure it out, is you push the button once and it drops like a mine on the ground, which I thought was an attack mine. But if you press the button again to detonate it while they're on top of it, it rocket launches them across a space. So interesting there, but it's considered like the description of it is like rocket jumps, but this is more like a landmine jump. But nonetheless, it just goes to show you like the different, they're fairly diverse in like what the different special abilities are. Now, once you've chosen the character, you're then thrust into the game, in which case there are five areas to go to. The game, at least the mode I was playing on, because there is a mode that says like each character starts as a specific building as opposed to what the game normally does, which is randomly places you on a building. Now, these buildings have their own distinct differences. Like for example, one might be littered with like Chinese objects and like Roman candles, boxes that can explode, and turrets that fire shuriken, which was an interesting choice. A turret would fire shuriken, but that's part of the theme and the interesting aspect of it. And then another one that's like more traditional, firing lasers and stuff. Once you're there, you are then tasked with pretty much exploring the environment. The environment is composed of obstacles you can break with your melee attack or your gun to get scrap, or opponents that want to murder you, gunmen, turrets, you know, the like. And as you blow them up, you will get also more scrap, or sometimes you might come across a treasure chest, which when you open up, you might get like, you know, scrap items or the occasional new gun or accessory item. Accessories being things that can augment your abilities, like, you know, faster projectiles for ranged fire, or healing, straight up healing, or like my favorite one was like a drone that fired a bullet every third bullet you fired, which ended up being really useful. But a variety of different things can come across. And once you've cleared the entire space, you are then given the option of exiting through one of the available gates that exit from that environment. And each gate has a marker on it indicating what sort of obstacle you're going to face in the next zone. So think of it kind of like a Slay the Spire or One Step from Eden would work, where they kind of give you a prompt on like, this is where you're heading if you go through this door. And you can always bring up the map in front of the door to determine what future routes will be accessible from the door you choose. So you're basically charting a node course through an environment. Sometimes on a stage, you'll find like a secret hatch, or you will find like a general store actually just straight up on the map, which you can walk up to spend scrap to buy items or new guns. And in regards to the secret hatch, when you go into those, it's like the random room event that you come across in a lot of roguelike or roguelite games. And it'll be, it could be anything from like a bunch of scrap lying around to new guns to a healing station. And usually if you find a secret hatch, you kind of just want to take them. There's no reason I've come across thus far, at least, to not use a secret hatch when you see one. And, of course, you keep doing this ad nauseum until the end of the level, in which case you will face a boss. Beat the boss, move on. If you don't beat the boss, wah, wah, wah. So sometimes when you beat a boss, you will unlock a new character, which will be available to you at the main station when you go back to restart your game. Now, as you're doing all this stuff and you're killing enemies, picking up objects or whatever, you are accruing a score. But the score isn't in your traditional sense of score, though it does give you high score rankings and stuff when you're done. But the score is also what is used to move the progression meter, which eventually unlocks new goods, like new guns that can show up on runs or new items that can show up on runs. There's a total of like 25 or 30 different things that ultimately get unlocked in this process. So you're unlocking new gear, you're unlocking new usable characters, and so forth. Now, when you die, the things that I gaze that are carried back, or any character unlocks, various blueprints you might come across, because every once in a while you'll also come across an item blueprint which you can use to make something at a workbench. These items could be like, you know, football helmet or a credit card, which allows you to get discounts on shop purchases and things of that nature. And you can also use the workbench to increase the power level of certain, like combining things. Like, I didn't do a ton with it because I'm a cheap bastard, but one thing I came across was like, I combined my double tap accessory, which is a thing that lets me fire something, occasionally fire two projectiles instead of one, along with my backstab accessory. And it became the double tap plus, which had a 30% chance of backstab damage and also had the 20% chance of double projectile. So it was worth doing, but it felt weird being like, okay, so I got to remember that this particular backstab item or this particular double tap has the backstab augmentation. So it got a little weird there for me. But the important part is you can augment stuff to combine the abilities in the workbench and some scrap to make it better. My overall thought on the game, though, is interesting in that it gets the basics right for sure. I mean, like, you're running around, you can dash around, you're shooting dudes with your twin stick, pew pew magic, just like these games do. You can press a button, switch between one of two different guns that, you know, of course, you find on the ground or whatever. But there was something about it that didn't particularly click for me as being like, oh, this is just fantastic. It felt more like it worked, it's okay. But it didn't like grab me in the way of something like, say, Enter the Gungeon has done in the past. The music, I will say, is legitimately forgettable. Like, turn that crap down. It sounds like you're playing in like the most blandastic, boring club you've ever been to in your life. Like, they could at least put some variety in there. Maybe the blandastic club wouldn't be so bad if they changed the tunes every once in a while. It says that constant oot. Like, no. Give me more music.
Boots and pants.
I'd be happy with boots and pants. I would have killed for some boots and pants. I've killed lots of things, and none of them drop boots and pants. They just drop scrap. But it would help to have more music in the game to diversify the experience instead of just having that constant track playing over. And yeah, I know there are people that will just like, don't play the music anyway, but I'm not one of those people. Music is put in the game to be listened to. I want to have music I want to hear in my game. So to me, that was like the only just like, this is just not good element that I came across in the game. But otherwise, it didn't stand out as being like exceptional in any way, but it also wasn't boring. Like, I enjoyed my time with the game. But in that regard, it also leads me to the idea of saying, like, I don't tend to do this extremely often, but I feel like in a world where this is like an extremely commonplace genre right now, it's worth saying that if you're not looking for a budget, you know, roguelike top down, then this could be a skip it. But if you're like hurting for more and the price definitely is enticing because this is fairly inexpensive.
Yeah, it's only $10. So what are your thoughts at $10?
I'd say it's at least a try it in that regard, because again, if you're hurting for it and the price is right, I think you'll have fun with it. It's just, this is one I would come to later in the scope of the genre on the Switch right now.
Cool. Works for me.
Pew, pew, pew.
All right. Next up is Tinytopia, developed by Meenik Games, published by Mastiff, released October 20th on Windows 10 for $14.99. Construct charming toy towns and cities atop tiny terrain. Combine building blocks to create new megastructures. Test your skills in the physics-based challenge stages, or simply unwind and obliterate everything with an array of cute catastrophes. Chris, tell us about your time with Tinytopia.
Cute Catastrophe used to be my nickname. Anyway. Yes. Awesome. Well, I'm sorry?
Oh. Just said awesome. Just loved it.
Oh, okay. I heard you, and it was like a ghostly voice in the distance, and I was like, sweet. This review is haunted. So yeah, Tinytopia. So yeah, this is a game that took me quite by surprise, because I open it up and it's like, okay, now choose your tutorial, and you like choose from like 20 different tutors, like, and it's just like different people who are talking to you, and they're all just kind of like regular people. And I was like, okay. And then I was like, all right, now it's time to build a house. And I was like, okay. So I built a house. It's like, now it's time to build another house next to that house and watch them automatically combine into a slightly larger house. So I was like, okay. And I was like, now you're going to need to build a coal plant somewhere around here so these guys can have power. I was like, I don't really like coal power, but okay, here you go. And so I was like getting a real like SimCity on the Super Nintendo sense out of things, right? Because it was like really exactly that, except you can change the camera angles and whatnot, you know, rotate and go into it. But you can actually force a bird's eye view down, which is really nice. But, you know, I was missing the squares with the R's and stuff, you know, from that game. But anyway, so you know, I was building along and stuff, and it was like, and you know, do different things, build different structures, you know, make sure you have commercial zones so that people can have jobs, and they have little briefcase icons if they don't have jobs. And then it was like, okay, now build a fire station. And I was like, okay. And you know, like all this stuff, that's the tutorial stage. And then they give you a regular stage where you have to basically do the, you know, take what you learned, build roads and houses and commercial zones and power and increase your population to like 1,000. We've all been there before. And eventually, you know, every time you do one of those things, it unlocks another stage, of which there are 22. And ultimately, you know, that's just going to unlock this like nice big sandbox mode. And yeah, I quite like that they give you a healthy amount of money. SimCity was always very stingy, unless you knew the $1 million code, which I do.
Yeah, which everyone did.
Everyone did. Yeah, I still use it.
That's the only way to play that game.
Yeah, but like these games will tend to start you off with like $100,000, and you're like, okay, and then, you know, and it's less complicated, you know, like you can extract more taxes from people without so many complaints, although if you do a bad job, of course, they're going to protest, and that's bad. You know, there's bad things that can happen. And eventually, you know, because these are tiny model towns, so like you get that sense of scale, like you can see like big toys like around your like field where you're playing and stuff. And you know, if you accidentally put a building on top of another building and you don't do it just right, the building falls over and breaks, and you know, then you lose that money. So you actually have to be a little bit precise on that. There's a reason for this, and that is that after a few levels of just, you know, hey, build a nice cute little town, have a good time, relax, like, okay, how would you like to build a town at the end of a ruler without flipping the ruler over? And you're like, oh. So then you like try to build as many buildings as you can, but you can't make any part of it too heavy, otherwise the ruler's going to flip. Then they're like, how would you like to make a town on two sides of a seesaw without knocking it all over? So you have to build a mirror town, and you have to do it in real time, because then the seesaw is going to start teetering in one direction if you build too much on one side, and you have to build on the other side or destroy something to get it to balance. And then they're like, how about you build a town on an upside down bicycle? And it just keeps going like that. Like, this game goes bonkers after a while. What starts off as just like a cool 3D SimCity eventually just becomes like, they completely troll you for like all these stages, and it's so fun. You know, they kind of bury the lead really with like saying, oh, it's combining sim and physics puzzles. I was like, yeah, it's making you like build these like towns in these like really crazy places, and like that's so cool. I've literally never seen anything like this. I hate this word, but I'm gonna say that it is pretty unique. apart from that, I mean, there's not a whole lot else to say about it. It's very tight. All the controls are basically in nice little icons on each side of the screen. You know, you've got your different things you can build that you just click on. You can use a controller as well in this game, but I actually found myself preferring the mouse. You can, you know, you just click on a type of building and then a sub building, and as you unlock more things, or as you build more things that are different than what you built before, it adds them to a blueprint, and then you have that building that you can now kind of shortcut yourself into building. And, you know, so there's all kinds of stuff like, you know, combining, like just stacking houses up and making larger and larger apartment buildings rather than simply building an apartment building. And then of course, like, SimCity, and of course, like they advertise, you have six different disasters that you can inflict upon your town at any point. And again, you know, there's definitely some rules as far as building the town, but you know, by the time you're building a town on a gosh darn seesaw, you're not going to care about that anymore.
True.
Like, oh, you want an extra police department? How about you shut up so that I don't kill you all? Knocking this thing over. So there you go. That's Tinytopia.
All right. Well, it's $15. What do you think of it?
Try and find a way to buy it twice, because this game is fantastic, and I absolutely say you should buy it. I can't believe it's only $15, but you know, whatever. Oh, I know. I voted today, root beer, against the cops, so don't worry.
Yeah. ACAB, that's right.
Yeah.
And
did
if
that
you
come up in the chat or something? I'm yes. Out of the way.
It did, Purnell, yes. Sweet. We're getting serious up in here.
Oh my lord. Could you imagine riots in Tinytopia? Adorable little riots.
Well, they'd be tiny, we know that.
Cute, yeah. And adorable riots.
And then you can send a cute and adorable tornado to take care of things.
Yay. Well, if you want to win a copy, keep an eye out on our Twitter, because we will have some giveaways to do. Us and Carnage, we got a couple copies to unload, so keep an eye on our Twitter, and maybe you could win yourself a copy eventually. But one final game to talk about tonight is called Head Over Heels, developed and published by Cubite Interactive, released October 28th on the Switch for $3.99. Head Over Heels is an isometric puzzle platform game with two playable characters that have been captured, separated, and imprisoned in the castle, Head and Heels. The player will have to use and combine all of their powers to get them both out of the castle and do all of the puzzles that are ahead. Chris, tell us about Head Over Heels.
Okay, so Head Over Heels actually has a lot in common with some of the other games that I've talked about today. It's isometric. It is actually a remake of a remake of an old game, and it is completely bonkers. So let's talk about it. Okay, so this was originally a British computer game from 1987 called Head Over Heels. It was on the ZX Spectrum and like six other different computers back in the day. You know, this is like the kind of game that was like one of those where it's like black and white, but it looks like there's like a piece of colored film over it, over like a certain part of it. You know, and that's what passed for color back then. It's just amazing stuff. It was remade into what we see today in 2003, and I'm about to make everybody very depressed. The time between 1987, when the game was first released, and 2003 is 16 years. No, is it? Yes, 16 years. The time between 2003 and right now is 18 years. So the remake is older now than the original game was when the remake came out.
I'm hanging up now.
I know. This is my favorite. This is my favorite bummer joke to give people is, you know, reminding them of the passage of time. So, yeah, this wonderful ZX Spectrum literally won like awards and stuff back in the day. Like, it's crazy how popular this game was. Got remade in 2003 and is, you know, totally in color. It's, you know, 3D-ish. It's like high quality sprites and whatnot. Better, you know, more fancy soundtrack. But the gameplay of it is that you play as two different dogs. One of them is like, one of them has very large feet, that's heels, and then one of them has a large head, and that's head, I guess. And so you run around this isometric dungeon kind of thing, and you know, try and activate these teleporters and go from room to room solving puzzles until you eventually get these two dogs together. And once you do that, you can actually kind of combine them, you know, into like just one dog riding another dog's shoulders. And you know, you actually use your combined powers to like solve some puzzles too. So the head dog can collect donuts, which he can use as projectiles, and you know, has like a slightly taller jump, and the other dog has a longer jump, but that jump is forced. That is to say, you can't just jump straight in the air, you have to jump in a direction, and so you know, hijinks ensue. But the heels dog eventually gets a bag, literally like just a handbag, and can then carry one item from elsewhere in the dungeon, and so that, you know, will create like another platform. So the way this game controls, if you look at it, you've seen it before. It's like Solstice and Equinox on the NES and Super NES respectively. It's all based on like that very, very old isometric puzzle game called Night Lore. And but if you look at it, you're just like, oh, this is a British puzzle game. Like, if you don't know, then that's what it is. And once you do know, you will always see it that way. And having said, it's very hard. It is exceedingly difficult because British people really love painful video games, especially from the like 80s and 90s. So yeah, it's all about getting those jumps just right, you know, getting to the very edge of the thing and, you know, timing it right, stacking everything just right, controlling a robot chess piece with Prince Philip's head into pushing a block over several spinning blades just right, and you know, different things. And your goal is to collect bunnies who are sleeping and various other animals too that are just kind of there in the stage. You have to figure out a way to get to them. It's very hard to describe this game much further than that, and fortunately I don't have to because it's extremely cheap. So
well, yeah, it's $4. What do you think?
Well, so this one is clearly in the fuck it, why not territory. Obviously, if you played this kind of game before, if you're a fan of like Solstice on the NES and not just for the badass soundtrack, then you'll find yourself right at home with this thing. It's a bizarre adventure with very clever puzzles and, like I said, that kind of precision that people who play these kind of games crave. If you're just a casual gamer, this one's fun to look at, but I would not suggest playing it just because the difficulty is very... it keeps the gate and how. So yeah, it's not forgiving for new players. So, you know, you might check out something like, oh, what's that one, Lumi or something? I think that one's a little bit easier. But that's another game that's kind of built off of this sort of idea of the isometric British puzzle game. But yeah, I'm going to say it's a fuck it, why not, or a try it. A buy it, of course, if you're a fan of old ZX Spectrum games and or 2003 remakes of ZX Spectrum games.
So it covers all the
yeah, we're ratings. Covering everybody here. Yeah. Yeah.
All right, well, that is it for this episode. We made it through another one.
Hooray.
Brooke, what do you think?
You know, I had a great time, but come back anytime you'll have me. If you ever have romance games you don't want to play, but you need to review, pop me up, Jerry.
No, if they're not on Xbox, we'll hit you up. Because if they're on Xbox, Aki wants them.
Okay, nice. She's like, if there's romance in the air, I'm here.
All right, well, that is it for this episode. We're going to play some music to wrap it up. Thanks to Tim for being here. Thanks to all you for being here. Brooke, thank you for coming on and getting stupid with us. We would love to have you back on anytime. So, yeah, do you have any final words to end the show? We'll give you the final words.
Just super nice meeting y'all. Guess that's it. I'm still thinking about how you own 13 cats. Not over that yet.